Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Well, good afternoon to another exciting episode of Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, Annie, along with all the coolest of all the coolest co-hosts in all of BTR land, Cool Mike. Good afternoon, Cool Mike.
Good afternoon. Thank you for that intro, Annie.
Yes.
Glad to be here.
I'm
microphone issues.
Well, is my mic again breaking up? It was sounding clear before.
It did sound clear, but it was ruffling. So,
okay.
As you introduced, maybe it could be just because you were introducing Cool Mike and we needed a drum roll. But I'm, I looked at the show description and your dedication. Wow. I normally find unusual. I like to find unusual or something different kind of tributes. Wow. This is really going to be a great one. Well, they're all great, but this kind of stands out.
Yes, it does. And I'll explain why I picked one out, but I'm cracking up because the chat room is going. Our friend Michael is in the chat room, and I went to say buongiorno, Isano, and I put bum giorno. Okay, I can't type. So Mike in the chat room is supposed to be buongiorno, Paisano. I apologize. I wanted to do today on the show, everyone that does listen to us, whether or not they are listening live through BTR on the internet, or if they're in the chat room or if called in, they know that every show we open up with a dedication to one of our military heroes, usually someone that has been killed in action. But I specifically chose this individual just to show that we have had heroes that have stood up for America from the birth of this nation up today, and we will have more and more men and women dedicated to our American cause that will show for the future. Our children will be doing this. But I wanted to show an example of someone that has gone above and beyond their call of duty, someone that wasn't even called to duty but stood up. And I wanted also to show that it's not just them that fought in the American Revolution. There were a lot of women that also fought for the revolutionary cause. And I chose this individual simply because she was the best example I could find. Not the only example, but the best one I could find to show the courage and the fortitude of the women in the forces. It's a little near and dear to me because those that listen know that I am retired NYPD, and I got into NYPD when there wasn't a lot of women and there was a lot of rough treatment that we got, but you took it. You took it on the chin. You didn't go whining, complaining. You did your job, and you did it as best as you can. You tried to do it better than anyone else. And this is what this hero has done, and I'm going to do the dedication for her. But before we get to that, I've got two short announcements. Want to remind everyone, we've got the Lieutenant Dan Weekend number 3 coming up this September, which will start September 9th through the 15th. We'll end with the Lieutenant Dan Band having a concert on the 15th of September, which stars Gary Sinise, you know, the actor from CSI New York. He was also Lieutenant Dan in Forrest Gump. He will be here with his band for the final concert, the finale. That will be September 9 to 15. Anyone interested, whether or not you actually physically come here and want a ticket, which is only $19 for the concert, or if you just want to make a donation for like $1 or $5, it goes to the Independence Fund. And in the Independence Fund, every dollar you donate, can you hear me out there, Michael? Because Cool Mike is saying that they're saying good. Rick has to reboot his computer because he's saying he can't hear. Anyway, every 99.9 cents of every dollar you donate to the Independence Fund or through the Lieutenant Dan Weekend number 3 website, 99.9% of that goes directly to the wounded veterans. Not 40 cents, not 50 cents, not 85 or 90. 99.9% of what you donate goes directly to the cause. And that's why I support the Independence Fund. You can find them at independencefund.org. Or if you want to go to the Lieutenant Dan Weekend site, it's LDW3, the number 3.com. So just take a moment and check out the website. And like I said, even if it's just a buck, every little bit helps. The other thing is, next Saturday, July 28th, Congressman Tim Scott, who represents here in the 1st District of South Carolina, is honoring World War II veterans in North Charleston Convention Center. At this time, they're telling people that want further information to directly call his office in Charleston, which is toll-free, and it's 888-868-0737. And that's the only two where I've got to go for this morning, Mike. And I think that's enough, isn't it?
No comment. But yes, for those who know, that's a little joke. When Annie and I first started this show, she'd be like, just a couple of announcements. Half hour into after the announcement, but and that's it. Like, dang. But anyway, yes, and that Lieutenant Dan Weekend. You know, our partnership, if you will, with the Wounded Warrior
Independence Fund.
Our partnership with the Independence Fund is that is really, of all my studies online, the best type of partnership we could have established. It seems like the most bang for the buck with that group. They do absolutely everything to make sure that $1 in full gets to do good. Whereas, and you know, other funds and stuff are very good too, and nothing's wrong. People who put a lot of time in there deserve to get paid for their work. But this is just a great partnership. I'm really happy. However it is you met up with these people, I'm really happy for it, and I appreciate all they do, as well as us being part of their program.
Yeah, and this will be the third year that they've been here in Anchorage, and this is the third year that I've worked with them in getting the word out. And last April, we actively had a radio show with Carolyn with some of the wounded veterans that came in and actually spoke on air, and was fantastic. I mean, looking at some of these guys just broke your heart, but looking at the courage they had to overcome their disabilities and to be on with their lives, it's so important that we help and support them. You know, you don't pamper them, you don't coddle them, you know, you shoot straight from the hip, and they like that. And that's what, you know, the Independence Fund does. You know, it's a hand up, not a hand out.
Yeah, and, great. Like it was amazing how many of these handicapped people or they're not even really handicapped. We call that as a name, but these some of these disabled, somewhat disabled, would sit right next to you, and they had the best sense of humor, is making jokes about just about everything. The one guy who doesn't have any legs is like the best golfer out of all of them. I mean,
oh, no, that was the one that was blind. That was the one that birdied.
Oh, the one that was blind. Can you imagine a blind guy?
Yeah, that was Master Christian Acosta. Yeah.
Yeah, that's just amazing. And with that said, why don't we do our dedication? Because I see we got Coach.
Yeah, Coach is on the line.
On hold. Coach
yeah,
C.
we're going to have Coach on in just a few minutes. But our dedication is today to Deborah Sampson of Sharon, Massachusetts. And Deborah Sampson was born in the town of Plimpton, Massachusetts on December 17th, 1760. She was the oldest of six children of Jonathan and Deborah Bradford Simpson of old colonial stock. The elder Deborah was a descendant of William Bradford, once governor of Plymouth Colony. Her siblings included Jonathan, Elijah, Hannah, Ephraim, Nehemiah, and Sylvia. The family lived in Middleborough, Massachusetts during her youth. Her family was poor. When Jonathan Sampson abandoned them, Deborah became an indentured servant. However, some sources say Jonathan Sampson instead sailed to Maine and remained there for the rest of his life. Deborah lived in several different households, first with a spinster, then with the widow of Reverend Peter Thatcher, and finally in 1770, at the age of only 10, she ended up an indentured servant of Deacon Jeremiah and Susanna Thomas. There she lived for many, many years. It was from the age of 8 to 17, 9 hard years. When she turned 18 and was released from her indentured, she became a school teacher. And in 1778, at the age of 18, she felt the need to go on adventure and explore the world, so she enlisted in the army as a continental soldier. However, in that day and age, women were not allowed to enlist, so she disguised herself as a man. She had some trouble doing this. She had little trouble doing this, since she was tall and educated. Even her own mother failed to recognize her while she was disguised as a man. In disguise, the recruiting officer listed her under the name of Robert Shirtless of Cora. Because of the notable manner in which she had a quill pen, she may have been recognized and did not report the next day for service. On the 20th, 1782, at the age of 20, she tried again. Time enlisted in the army of Master Noah's Cat of Uxbridge under the name of her deceased brother, Robert Shirtless, and his residence at Uxbridge, Massachusetts. She was chosen for the light infantry company of the 4th Matthews under the command of Captain George Webb. And it consisted of 60 men and was first quartered in Bellingham, Massachusetts. And later, the unit mustered at Worcester under the 4th Massachusetts Regiment, commanded by Colonel Hubbard. Although she had some trouble with the regiment, after she looked in on the men changing, and you can imagine, her distant cousin, Friend Noah Alden, a minister in Bellingham, kept her secret. Sampson fought several skirmishes during her first battle on July 3rd, 1782, at least 1.5 months after signing up. Outside of Paragon Town, New York, two muskets in her thigh and an enormous cut to her heart. She begged fellow soldiers to let her die, not take her to the hospital, but she was too abandoned. And a soldier put her on his horse, and they rode 6 miles to a hospital. The doctor treated her head wound, but she left the hospital before they could attend to the musket balls. Being that her true identity would be discovered, she wielded one of the balls herself with the penknife and sewing, but her legs never fulfilled the musket. On April 1, 1783, she was promoted to spend 7 months serving as General John Patterson. The job did entitle her to a better quality of life, better food, less danger, and a shelter. But after the peace treaty was signed, everyone thought it was over. However, on June 24th, President of Congress ordered General Washington to send a fleet of soldiers to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to aid in squelching a rebellion of several American officers. During summer 1783, Samson sent down with malignant fever and was cared for by a doctor, Barnabas Biddy. He proposed to treat her and discovered the force to bind her body and thus destroyed her. He did not betray his sister. He took her to his house. His wife house treated her. At Samson's courage, she returned to the army, but not for long. In September 1783, he was assured through the signing of the Treaty of Paris. November 3rd was the date for the soldiers to be sent home. Dr. Binney asked her to deliver a note to General John Patterson. She thought that her secret was out. However, General Patterson never uttered a word. Instead, she received an honorable discharge from service, a note with some words of advice, and some of the money sufficient to bear her expenses home. Thus, on October 25, 1783, General Henry Knox honorably discharged Deborah Samson from the Army at West Point after a year and a half of service. Deborah was married in Stockton, Massachusetts, Benjamin Gannett, a farmer from Sharon, Massachusetts, on April 7, 1785, and they had children. 8 years later, January 1792, Samson petitioned the Massachusetts state legislature for pay, which the Army had withheld from her because she was a woman. Her petition passed the Senate and was approved, then signed by Governor John Hancock. The General Court of Massachusetts verified her service and wrote that she exhibited an extraordinary instance of female heroism by discharging the duty of faithful, gallant soldier, and at the same time preserving the virtue and chastity of her gender unsuspected and unblemished. The court awarded her a total of 34 pounds. 10 years later, in 1802, Samson began giving lectures about her experiences in the Army. These speeches, my tongue is in backwards today, I'm sorry, were initiated because of her financial needs and a desire to justify her enlistment. But even with these speaking engagements, she was not making enough money to pay her expenses. She had to borrow money from her family and from her friend Paul Revere on many occasions. The soldiers in the Continental Army had received pensions for their services, but Samson did not because she was a female. In 1804, Paul Revere wrote to Massachusetts Representative William Eustis on Samson's behalf. He requested that Congress grant her a military pension. This had never before been requested by or for a woman. But with her health failing and the family being destitute, the money was needed greatly. Revere wrote, "I have been induced to inquire her situation and character since she quit the male habit and soldier's uniform. For the more decent apparel of her own sex, humanity, and justice obliges me to say that every person with whom I have conversed about her, and it is not a few, speaks of her as a woman with handsome talent, good morals, a dutiful wife, and an affectionate parent." On March 11, 1805, Congress in Washington obliged the letter and put her on the Massachusetts Invalid Pension Roll. This pension plan paid her $4 a month, a mere $48 a year. On February 22, 1806, she found herself in even more financial trouble. So she wrote once more to the year, asking for a loan of $10,000. Part of her letter read, "My own position and that of my son caused me again to see his goodness in our favor. I, with gratitude, invest about his great every kind of feeling, and I bless the Lord in 99 victories at the end. My circumstances require that I should pass the 100th. Sent the $10. In 1809, she sent the petition to Congress asking that her pension as an infant soldier given to her in 1804 commence at the time of her discharge in 1783. Had her petition been approved, she would have been awarded $960 to be divided into $48 a year. However, it was denied until 1806 when her petition came to Congress again. This time, they are purposely awarding her $76 expense a year. And with this amount, she was able to pay all her loans, take better care of her family phone. She died on April 29, 1826, of yellow fever, and was buried in Rockbridge Cemetery, town of Sharon, Massachusetts. Her long and ultimately successful public campaign, the American Revolutionary War Pension, gender differences, inserting the sentencing title felt by all the veterans, went to the Sharon and memorialized Samson, a Deborah Samson statue in front of the public library, and a Deborah Samson and Deborah Samson house. That's the story of okay, fine. Okay, Mike.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm
that was
good.
The.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, you haven't bumped the music.
Oh no, I'm sorry about that. You kind of got a little ruffled just at the end, and on top of that, as I forgot to hit the unmute on my phone, so as a combination of me bad. But anyway, that's really amazing. $4 a month.
Well, I would assume $4 a month is probably close to like about maybe $100 a month in today's dollars. And even that, people can't live off of that. But, you know, they managed. They didn't have the cars. They didn't have all the luxuries like we have. So, yeah, if you were doing the bare basics, that's what you were getting, $4 a month.
Yeah, that's and I mean, we overlook just many of the great things that people in general, whether it's a male or girls or whatever, have done in the fight for the freedom. There was a lady, I had a link one time, I'll have to try to dig it up, who was at the time just would be stunning, really, really beautiful. And she basically would get some of the Southern, not the generals, but the Southern military leaders, she'd basically get a chance to seduce them, and then basically she'd knife them. So that does an awful lot for the Republic as well. But, I mean, it just goes to show you, I mean, in war or in espionage, whatever it is, yesterday's war and espionage is the same as today. I mean, they use every single means necessary. And this lady was really, really a great hero. I'm really glad that you dug this up.
Yeah,
anyway.
One of the things that Deborah Simpson did is when she did on her speech tour, she was out dressed as a woman. And she would do her speech and explain everything, why she did it and how she had survived and everything. At the end, she would walk away, get changed into her street uniform, come back on, and do the full soldier's drill with her rifle. Just to show, hey, women can do this. And she's the first feminist. But
that's
let's
awesome.
Let's bring our guest on. And today's guest is a friend of mine, Dr. Kevin Coach Collins. He's a member of America Men's, so don't try to trick him, and the Sons of American Revolution. He holds a doctoral degree in public administration from Nova Southeastern University, and he brings a unique background to his endeavors. He's a Vietnam War vet, a Marine, so listen up, and a retired NYPD Honor Legion street cop, who was assigned to many sensitive positions during his time with the department. And for many years, he's been an adjunct professor at both behavioral science at several colleges in the New York City area. His love of playing and teaching basketball has brought him the name he is known to his friends and family as Coach. So I want to welcome aboard Coach Collins. How are you doing today, Kevin?
Doing very well. Thank you for having me. You know, as you were reading the story about Deborah Samson, I couldn't help thinking that how the fortunes of war shift, and here's a woman who certainly was very active in the revolution as a soldier, and she got very little in the end out of it. And as you mentioned, I am a member of the Sons of the American Revolution by virtue of the fact that my eighth great grandfather fought with the 8th Albany Militia, and they were largely not English-speaking troops. They were Dutch, and they took care of themselves after the war, because my eighth great grandfather he didn't get any pay, but he got 640 acres of land, which I would suspect was probably worth a lot more than $4 a month. So, you know, it's a shame that it worked out that way. And it was really a good fine thing of you to point out the exploits of this fine American patriot, even so many years later.
Yeah, and the hardest part is being a female. I can definitely relate to this because our equipment is slightly different here, guys. Can you imagine having to bunk down at night or to use any sort of a latrine facility, or you're out in the field and just basic common things that guys take for granted that women have to kind of figure out a way to get around. You know,
yeah,
they had
sure.
to push a little bit further. You know, if you go out and fishing, you know, a guy just hangs it over the side. I'm sorry if it sounds a little crude, but that's what you guys do. A woman really can't do that.
Right.
So, you know, the way she had to be creative and survive a year and a half hiding her gender.
Sure.
It is amazing. And then to stand there side by side with these men and to fight in actual combat and never show weakness and never showing fear and doing what you have to do. And it was basically the same thing we had as a cop on the street. You know, some guys would go into anywhere and use the restroom. And you know, some of those places out on the beat are not the best. And sometimes I would go into a place and think, oh, ma'am, you really don't want to use this. The guys use that one. I go, I don't care. You know, you just got to do what you got to do.
And, I remember those days. Yep.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So I want to welcome you aboard our show. And you've got a book, which I have to tell everyone that you are a friend of mine, and you have a condo unit near where my parents are, just a few doors down, so that's how I came to meet you. And when I left there in Fort Lauderdale recently, you handed me your book, and I read it, and I was hysterical. It's called Crooks, Thugs, and Bigots, The Lost, Hidden, and Changed History of the Democratic Party. And I'm telling you guys, you've got to go to his website, and the website is thecoachisright.com, and get his book. You will laugh and cry at the same time.
Cut the T out. It's coachisright.com, and the book has its own website, crooksthugsandbigots.com. So it's a very easy read, as you know. It's only about 245 pages, but it's backed up with 12 pages of footnotes. And it's offered as an ebook for just $7, and you can get a hard copy if you follow the instructions that are there as well. But it's priced so that everybody can get it. And it's a quick, easy read, and it'll certainly tighten the jaws up of some of your Democrat friends and relatives, as you know, Annie.
It definitely will make some of them go a little berserk. I can think of a few. But you back it up with, you know, actual documents and facts and say, hey, listen, if you don't believe me, look at the footnote and here it is. This is where you can see where it's an actual. And you trace the origins of the Democratic Party all the way through the day, well with their attack on America. And I think everyone, every good conservative or Republican should read it and find it very, very enlightening.
Well, yeah, sure. You know, we have been fed an endless stream of one-sided propaganda. I think that it really turned, the volume was really turned up on this with the first Roosevelt administration in 1932. It seemed right there, the media got in the tank for Roosevelt. He was, ironically, he was not their man, but they just fell in love with him right after he was elected. And, you know, it's been that way ever since. And we are now dealing with the, in some cases, journalists who are the granddaughters and grandsons of the people that wrote this propaganda for Roosevelt in the early 1930s. So I just felt, look, it's about time that we heard a little bit of the other side. And I used the skills that I have as a researcher and the basic skeptical attitude that we both developed as cops to go into this. And I really didn't know what I would find. I suspected that it wouldn't be all that flattering to the Democrats when I started to do the research. But I frankly had no idea that it would be as bad as it is. And oftentimes I would finish a day's work and I would feel like I had to take a shower because I had been with these people for so many hours of the day. There's 350 hours of research in this book, and I'm sure that those who pick it up and will read it, whether in the hard copy or the ebook, will recognize that. But just right from the beginning, right, its origins trace back to Aaron Burr, that Aaron Burr.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Nat, they like to say that Thomas Jefferson was one of the founders of the Democratic Party. That's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. Jefferson would roll over in his grave and puke on his shoes if he knew what they were doing to his good name.
Oh, man. Explain how Aaron Burr is the father of the true father of the Democratic Party. What exactly was he doing?
Oh, absolutely. And then, you know, well, Burr was a classic. Burr would fit in today's Democrat Party. He was an opportunist that was really a very, very dangerous man. He was actually arrested in February of 1807 because he shot and killed Alexander Hamilton in a legal duel, although there are people that say that Hamilton naively thought that both of them would just fire into the ground and let it go. And the question is, well, why did they have this duel? Now, we never heard this when we were kids because they didn't want you to hear it. Aaron Burr was in league with Andrew Jackson, yeah, Old Hickory, and they plotted to militarily take the Louisiana Purchase properties that we had just, as a nation, had just gotten in 1803 and carved them up into so many slave states. So Burr was a very low-rent character, and Hamilton was appalled by this, and he went around Washington telling everybody that would listen, you know, saying, hey, this guy is a real bad actor. This guy has been involved in some very bad stuff. And, of course, as it turned out, you know, Burr blew his stack. He challenged Hamilton to a duel, and Hamilton foolishly accepted. And in July of 1804, they met in Weehawken, New Jersey, and, you know, it turned out badly for Hamilton, who was killed. But after that, Burr kind of floats around, and he winds up in Europe, and he's pitching the various European countries, saying that, you know, if you back my play to take over the Louisiana territories, we're going to have a good relationship for trading, etc. And I know that this is hard for people to really think, you know, wrap their head around. But in 1803, in the early part of the 19th century, we didn't have much of an army. We really didn't, you know. And it would have not been very difficult for an armed force to actually take over New Orleans and take the whole area. So anyway, what happens is that Burr bounces around. He winds up being shut out by all of these various European countries. He comes back to America He's broke. He's a broken man. And he's in New York City, involved in politics. He starts the the Tammany Hall Club, which turned out to be probably the most corrupt Democrat machine for the next 100 years. So that's his contribution to history. And he crosses paths with the widow Jumel. This is Eliza Jumel. Now, Eliza was an interesting character. See, she was married to Pierre Jumel, who was a rich French merchant. And at some point, when Pierre started to ask too many questions about his young bride and her background, and he found out that she really wasn't a princess from Europe, but actually a streetwalker from Providence.
That's cracking up, having read the book.
Shortly after that, Pierre got dead. Pierre got dead after that, yeah. And so I could imagine a conversation when the former vice president meets the hooker, and it's, hey, you got the money, honey, and I got the name. So Eliza says, you know, I got to clean up my act here. So she marries the former vice president, Aaron Burr, and after just 3 years, the streetwise hooker realizes that she's being taken for a ride, and her fortune is being dried out by this crook Burr, and she sends him a divorce notice, which was this part is near to my heart because I live in Staten Island, besides in Florida. On September 14th, 1836, the mailman found Burr dead in the Hotel St. James on Staten Island when he tried to deliver the divorce papers to Aaron Burr. So that's Aaron Burr. And that's the beginning. This is the guy who founded Tammany Hall and founded what is now the actual Democrat Party. This is he brought forward Andrew Jackson, and of course Jackson was the first Democrat president, and and away they went. So we've been on this 200-year merry-go-round with these people. They never seem to stop. They are the same people over and over again. It's just different faces, different clothes, but the same playbook. No, yeah.
There was a huge riot in the Civil War, the draft riot, and Tammany Hall was directly responsible for that riot because they really didn't want the Union soldiers to go south to free the slaves. So Tammany Hall was also tied directly into promoting slavery in New York.
Absolutely. New York it uses the motto or the nickname, the Empire State, and they got that as a result of the Civil War. New York City was floating in money during the Civil War because they were benefiting by the Erie Canal, which connected the Hudson River with the Great Lakes, so that trading with Chicago and the Upper Midwest was never disrupted. And by the Civil War, and the only way that these cities in the Midwest, like Chicago, Milwaukee, and Cleveland, could get goods was through New York City. So, and of course, New York City was a Democrat cesspool then, as it is now, and they were charging confiscatory taxes and port fees. So they loved it. And meanwhile, they wanted no part of having New York City involved in an effort to free slaves. As a matter of fact, in 1861, immediately in the beginning in January, Fernando Woods, the mayor of New York City actually brought a bill before the city council for New York to secede from New York State and become a city state affiliated with the Confederacy. This is how much the Democrats were aligned with the Confederacy right up all the way through Jim Crow and all the way through the 1960s into the 70s and 80s, and the only time that these people and their descendants have ever been brought to heel is through the tip of a gun in the Civil War and by various times when troops had to be brought in, as in Arkansas and Little Rock in 1954, and finally by the ballot box when the Republicans started to be elected in the states that are the Old South, the Confederate states, and cleared these people out.
Yeah. Now, you, going back to Andrew Jackson, if I remember correctly, wasn't he the first one that tried to initiate gun control?
Yeah, well, Jackson, just a little bit, in 1835, he was the subject of the first attempted assassination of an American president. A guy named Richard Lawrence, who was so crazy that he called himself King Richard of England, tried to shoot Jackson, and fortunately, both of his guns malfunctioned. And Lawrence was so crazy that even in 1835, it took a jury 5 minutes to declare him criminally insane and put him away. But that wasn't good enough for Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson then used the opportunity to blame his, and see if this sounds familiar, blame his political enemies for putting King Richard up to trying to assassinate him. He really reached, he blamed a guy that he had a run-in with, actually, the prosecutor in the case where he should have been an indicted conspirator, but he was an unindicted co-conspirator, and that was the Aaron Burr case when they tried to take over the Louisiana territories. This was 28 years before, and Jackson thought, well, here's a chance now, so I'm going to blame this on Henry Clay and a guy named George Poindexter, a senator from Mississippi. And Poindexter had been the prosecutor when that case came up, and he destroyed Poindexter's career. Poindexter could never win another election anywhere, and he was finished in politics. So, you know, when we see what happened with Gabrielle Giffords when she was shot, and the left immediately wanted to blame Sarah Palin, and then most recently we've seen this shooting in Colorado, and immediately the left wants to blame us in the Tea Party. When I say us, I mean I am a board member of my local Tea Party. This is nothing new. These people have been doing this stuff for 200 years. That's par for the course. It's right out of their playbook.
Absolutely. You got to separate the people from their guns, and therefore people cannot have an uprising.
Yep.
Yanni is making a little note telling me to say hello to you.
Hi, Yanni.
Thanks.
He's saying hello and thank you for help.
I have a question for the coach. You mentioned you're on your board of your Tea Party. What city do you live in, if you don't mind me asking?
No, you know, I don't mind you asking. I'm glad you asked. It's the Staten Island Tea Party. We threw out our Democrat Congress in 2010. So that was us that did that.
Wasn't that guy who was showing his private parts around on the cell phone, was it Wiener?
No, Wiener was Brooklyn.
That was it, across the Verrazano in Brooklyn. But the Tea Party helped, and my Tea Party helped elect Bob Turner to that open seat there too. So we've been very active there, and we've been on the buses into Washington every time there's been something big, and we're going to be very active in the fall. So the Tea Party is very important as a political player on Staten Island.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to tell everyone. Yeah. Everyone keeps on saying Tea Party's dead, Tea Party's dead. And he says, nope, you just wait. Wait until the summer's over, and it's going to get hot in the fall.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, you go extensively into the history of the KKK, and this predates, people think KKK, all right, right-wing nuts and everything else. But no, you actually go down to the very start of it and who was first Grand Wizard and so forth. It's fascinating, interesting. You want to go into some of that?
Yeah, well, sure. At the end of the Civil War, there was a large section of Democrats. And, the Democrats and the Confederates were part and parcel. They were the same people, okay? So let's get that straight. The Democrats could not accept that they had been defeated, which is the same way today. You have to defeat them again and again and again, and they try to weigh you down. And so instead of accepting what had happened, they first tried to passive resistance so that they would not have to give African Americans their rights. Then they sent their representatives back to Washington as congressmen and senators, and they voted against every single Republican attempt to give rights and freedoms to the African Americans who had been slaves and were freed at the point of a gun by the Union Army just a few years before. And when none of that seemed to work, and the black people said, we like this freedom, and we like this right to vote, and we're voting. And they actually wound up with black governors in the Old South, and black senators and black congressmen, who are all Republican, every one of them. They decided to go Occupy Wall Street type. And that was the forerunner of that. And they, except that these guys would dress up in sheets to make believe that they were ghosts to scare people. When that didn't work, they started to shoot people. They started to hang people. They started to burn them out. And this was the Ku Klux Klan. Now,
Coach, are you, I don't mean to interrupt, but are you sure of your information? Because we've been told by the media and by teachers and professors for 100 years, Republicans have always hated blacks and tormented them, and they were against slavery, and it was the Democrats that were so much for freedom and all this.
Yes, well, I understand, and that's why I include 12 pages of footnotes, because I understand the point that you're making, of course, but as I wrote this, I'm saying I'm going to include my footnotes there because I know that there are people who will read this and say this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Well, I do know what I'm talking about. These people were the first domestic terrorists. They were the grandparents, the grandfathers, if you will, of Bill Ayers and his gang. And they were disgusting creeps that, here's an interesting turn. In 1870, Ulysses Grant, who had been the head of the Union Army and had won the freedom for African Americans, again at the tip of a gun in the field, had enough of what was going on down south. And he ordered the Republican-controlled Congress to institute the Department of Justice. And the Department of Justice was specifically tasked with protecting the rights to vote of African Americans. So you had a white president who selected Amos Akers, a white attorney general, and put him in charge of the newly formed Department of Justice, whose job it was to make certain that black people could vote. And what do you have today? You have a black president who appoints a black attorney general who believes that his job is to help the new Black Panther Party take away the right to vote of white people. So everything is upside down, and it is in the typical way that Democrats pervert things.
It is. It's very, very interesting. And the cover of your book, you've got this reward sign, and it's your sense of humor. When I read it, I actually heard your voice talk. It goes, reward, capture and return runaways from the Democratic Party's liberal plantation. Any person of color claiming to be Republican, conservative, or a member of the Tea Party is suspect and should be berated, insulted, abused, and returned. Be on the lookout. Runaways often speak in uppity manner about the rights of the individual, personal responsibility, the greatness of America, and other such nonsense. The Democratic Party, the party of Jim Crow, the party of Bull Connor, is not. So, in the not-so-distant past, would lynch people of color for voting Republican. Then we learn it's far better to just buy their votes using taxpayer money, and for over 40 years, that is what we have done. We own them. Note, the amount of cash reward is getting results of fundraising efforts. You don't expect us to use our own money, did you? I love it.
Yeah. That piece of artwork was donated to me by someone who heard about my project online. I wasn't sure how it worked out, but he said, Coach, I want you to have this, if you will. And I said, absolutely. Are you kidding me? I think that it lays the tone for the book. It lets you know that this isn't a kindergarten book. This isn't everybody winds up walking away together singing Kumbaya. This is a book for adults who want to know the truth and have the feeling that they have not heard the truth about the Democrats their entire life, and they're not liable to hear the truth about them from any place else. Now, of course, there's other books that I have borrowed from and acknowledged naturally, but they hit specific areas. This is a book designed to whet the appetite of people. And of course, at the end of the book, in the closing lines, I encourage people to be excited by what they've just read and go out and do their own research. Don't stop there. Let this be the catalyst for you to find your own ammunition, because there's plenty of it. Certainly, I part of my job was cutting down stuff and having to leave things out so I would get it down to where I wanted it to be, around 250 pages. I didn't want it to be War and Peace that nobody would use and just use as a doorstop. You know, I wanted people to read it, and that's why it you know, my website. The niche of my website is that my writers and I put up 300 to 500 word essays. So if you can't say it in 500 words, we're suspect of you right away. And this is this book is of course they're not just 500 word paragraphs, but it's in the same fashion, and that I think makes it an attractive read for a lot of people.
Yeah, and then your website is The Coach is Right. And I'm looking at one of your articles, because you're talking about the White House controlling the news back in pre-Civil War times, but this is exactly what's going on right now in this current White House. They have the National Press Corps. Before they print everything, it has to be approved by the White House. Excuse me, what happened to the First Amendment?
No, it's gone. It's gone. They, the media has totally abrogated its responsibilities, and you have to learn to take the part out of it. It's not, it's coachesright.com, not the coaches right, because I've had people send me nasty emails. What is this? There's no such thing as the coaches right. Well, it's coaches right. And on coaches right, I have a great staff of writers, and one of them is Doug Book. And Doug, the piece you're talking about, is up right now on the site. And, you know, it tells you that something is really wrong here. It's really wrong. The people that got up and grabbed a gun and went out into the street 240 years ago didn't do this so that these slimy characters in the media today can sell us out by acting like they're in some third world country somewhere where Alexa Hente comes out in dark glasses and a thick mustache and hands out the press releases and then turns and walks away, which is exactly what the Democrats want and exactly what the media of today wants as well.
Yeah, and Fed Pablum.
Yes. Yeah, as long as it doesn't say anything offensive about their prince, you know, fine. Then let's go with it.
I think it's also why they want that net neutrality, so they can control your voice and mine by controlling the internet. That does away with conservative voice on the internet, conservative blog like yours. And they want to control every aspect of it. And it's a very scary thing. You know, there's something else that's happening today about these new drones that their AA has allowed to fly over. And they're still going to be between 5,000 and 6,000 the first year, up to 30,000. And this is a huge, huge privacy concern. I also was hearing something recently about these new smart lampposts that actually not only do face recognition, they do voice recording, they do body x-rays, they do a heck of a lot of things. It's as if no matter where you go, someone is going to be watching you.
It's absolutely
really scary.
Yeah, and this is exactly the type of stuff. Do you remember the foolishness over the Patriot Act when these phony balonies were crying about whether or not somebody in the government was going to see what book you checked out in the library? What a pile of manure that was. And yet, where are those people today when you have actual drones flying over farms to see how farmers are conducting their own business? Again, it's just the basic approach is that the Democrats are for the Democrats. They are not for America. They never have been. And it sounds like such a jingoistic, exaggeration on my part. How could you say it? That's a typical right-wing thing. But I defy anybody to really show me where what I'm saying doesn't add up, because it's there every day. You're part of the media. You yourself, you read this stuff every day, and you see it in, right? It's right in front of your face, what they're doing.
Exactly. And they have these new scanners out, where they can drive around in a panel van. The panel van can pull up to your car, and there you are with you and your kids heading to wherever the store or whatever. They can actually x-ray everything that's in the car. So they don't need a search warrant, and all of a sudden, oops, they see a gun. Your car is being pulled over. It may not matter the fact that you're a licensed gun holder and you were just simply going to the church or taking your kids to dance or whatever, and you have a legal right. They have just done a search of your vehicle without a warrant. And the same thing with these smart lamps. They can turn around as you're walking down the street. You know, do an x-ray on your attaché case or your purse. And where is the search warrant now? Where is probable cause? It doesn't exist anymore. They have taken that all away. And what is the report?
No, go ahead, Annie. Sorry.
What they're just doing that for is so they can do a search and seizure without having to go through the legal process.
Yeah, well, I had a friend when I was explaining that they can now fly drones in the U.S. make a comment. Well, they'd never use it against us, though. The American people would never stand for it. And I thought, oh, geez, not another idiot. I mean, basically, it started with the checking out of the book. And the bottom line is, Ronald Reagan says it the best: those who have the most to lose care the least. And it's that simple. I mean, let's face it: if you're really, really, really rich, you're always going to be able to fight the system. But when you're just like us, next thing you know, we're just taking marching orders. And sadly, throughout history, at least up until the 30s, that's all we've done is take marching orders. I mean, they did Prohibition, we took it. They marched all the Japanese into internment camps. They told us to turn in our gold, and we did it. I mean, sooner or later, we as people need to either stand up for our democracy, for our republic, or we need to just take it.
Well, Coach, I think you agree with me. What makes the thing with the drones so scary, because, you know, you have the law enforcement and the military background, so scary is now that they have these drones and these smart lamps and these panel x-ray vents, it's going to make it impossible for second American revolution. No matter what, they're going to be able to monitor your phone calls, your text messages. They're going to monitor your movements. Now they're putting GPSs in the car. They've got progressive with this thing that you put in there, and it tells you how fast you're going and where you're driving and everything. I refuse to come close to any company that does something like Progressive does, because it's basically an unwarranted search of your vehicle that you dumbly don't even know you gave permission to. It's going to make, should it be coming to the point where we need to do an actual uprising, that it cannot happen because they'll squash it before it even starts.
Well, I agree, and that's, of course, why we have to make certain that we win in November, and I'm sure we will. And I have a page at the top of the homepage, things that that every American can do to beat Obama, and I invite people to go to the site and download the material. It's stuff that I have learned over the years. I've been in elected politics for 25 years. I've been in war rooms in the planning stages of things, and I think that I know what I'm talking about. And I think that if you're sitting listening to this and you're saying, what can I do? There's nothing that I can do. It's just not true. There are a number of things. I have about 15 or 17 things that were just off the top of my head, that things that you can do to see that we win. A lot of them are fun. And besides joining the local Tea Party and get involved with other people, there are things that are easy to do, and you're going to feel like you are part of the victory when it comes in November.
Why is it seems like we just fall in line? It just seems like, why are we not, I mean, when you talked about the Patriot Act, let's go way even further back to, you know, the Federal Reserve or the endearment case, just whatever. Why is it we just seem to just fall in line and march?
You know what? Because I think that for the most part, the American people are a good, honest people who, unfortunately, to our detriment at times, are willing to look at our government as good and honest people as well. Because after all, they're not kings. We elected them. So we didn't make a mistake. So even though we don't particularly maybe like what they're doing, maybe that's where things have to be. I know, look, my father, God rest him, was born in 1909, so he was scorched by the Depression. and which was exacerbated to great extent by Franklin Roosevelt. And I mean, this guy would practically bless himself at the phrase federal government. My father had a reverence in his voice, and you know, the guys, especially Democrats, of course, others would feed on that and work on that. So you know, it's nothing new. They've been doing that. The media has been doing that. The media got us into the Spanish-American War, and the media helped Wilson get us into World War One. And as you say, the confiscation of gold was an outrageous illegal act done by King Franklin the First. But you know, we're a different people now. We are finally, I think, awakening to what's been going on. And of course, the internet is the modern Paul Revere that they can't stop. And you know, I think that these are times when we're going to see who's right and who's wrong come November. And I think it's going to be us. I think the biggest fight that we have will be in January, which will be to decide what we want to have fixed first. And I hope that people understand that winning in November is really the beginning. It's not the end. It's just the beginning of the house cleaning and the disinfecting of our federal government and state government and city government in a lot of places. That's got to be done. It's just the beginning of it.
Absolutely.
I agree. I think we're going to see true conservative Tea Partiers hold their ground. They're not going to be the John Roberts or the Sandra Day O'Connor wishy-washy Republicans. I think these people are going to move for rescindment of many of the laws that have stolen our liberties. And I think what you're going to see is a small number hold the ground against what, quote-unquote, is the establishment. I think you're going to see the establishment more almost panic, because you're going to see the numbers of people like us, the Annies and the Coach Collins and the Cool Mikes and the many others. I think what you're going to see is all of a sudden a huge crowd behind them, and we're going to be holding our pitchforks and shovels. And they're going to think, wow.
Speaking of holding the ground, we got Doc Jones waiting on the line. So let's bring Dr. C. Robert Jones on with Dr. Kevin Coach Collins. Doc Jones, welcome aboard.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. I am I'm a big fan of your guest, Mr. Collins, Professor Collins. I'm just down the road over here at Pembroke Pines today from Nova. And Coach, or should I call you Professor? What do you prefer?
Well, no. Coach is fine. Please, we're friends here.
Indeed. Coach, where do you see America going in November if Obama's reelected?
Well, first of all, let's make it very clear. I don't see him reelected, and on my site, I've been saying consistently, I've been saying for a year and a half that we could pick a name from the phone book and beat Obama. Unfortunately, we did. The man that we have is my fourth choice, but he's mm-hmm. the one that that they gave me to dance with, and I'm going to dance with him. If somehow Obama is elected, I see actual catastrophe, because at this point, the circumstances that would have brought about an Obama reelection will be so suspect that it will cause civil unrest. I believe, I do not want to see it, but that's, you asked me what I think and what I see, and that's why it's very important to beat him. I think that I wrote a piece a little while ago where I coined a phrase which will be constructive secession. You know, in mm-hmm. civil divorce, we have constructive abandonment, and constructive secession would be merely to stop cooperating with the federal government.
You know, Coach, I see just an inkling of that occurring at this stage with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, where there are several states. I'm not sure exactly how many are opting to not participate on some level or another. And even Governor Perry somewhat jokingly hinted at seceding as a result of the heavy-handedness of this current regime. I'm not sure I agree that, you know, Obama is going to be so easily defeated. Even with all that we've learned so far as it relates to his background, his ideology, that he's still pretty much neck and neck with Romney in the polls at this juncture. Even with that latest remark he made about small businesses, one would think if we were back in the 80s or even the 70s, this guy would be done by now. But yet
Address the poll question, but let me ask if Professor Jones, have I answered your question, sir?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Look, I've spoken to this about the polls. Let's say that you and I took control of Belmont Racetrack, which is in New York, and it was in the off season, and we opened it up and asked people to come in. Nobody would come in because there's no horse race to watch. Well, the polls are run by people who run businesses who need a horse race. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that we are getting true polls. And here's an underlying, every time I discuss this and people say, oh, no, Coach, you know, here's something. Think about this. Barack Obama right now is not winning any group that he lost in 2008, and he's not doing better with any group, including blacks, that he won in 2008. Mm-hmm. Okay? So where are these votes coming from? Who are these people speaking to? In many cases, they are using faulty voter representation breakdowns. One of these polls recently used a breakdown that had Democrats going to the polls at a 9-point edge over Republicans. That didn't even happen in 2008, and no one can tell me that Democrats are more excited to vote, first of all, than Republicans. That's just off the chart. But they're not more excited to vote than they were in 2008. And even amongst African Americans, already in North Carolina and in Georgia, 20% are saying that they will not only not vote for Obama, but they will vote for Romney.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you got to say, hey, listen, where are you getting this stuff from? And it's got to be that it makes a horse race. As far back as 2 months ago, Dick Morris said Dick Morris, spent a lot of money to have a poll done of only likely voters. This was 2 months ago, and Morris found Romney +9, and he purposely made the survey so large that the margin of error was 1.9. So, you know, really, even Rasmussen, these people make their money by putting on horse races. They do not make their money by saying, look, here's the truth. Obama's down, you know, like 6 points already, and he's going south, and it's not coming back. Look at Virginia. In Virginia, Rasmussen has Romney down 2, which means Romney is probably up about 6. in Pennsylvania. He has Romney down 44. But that doesn't include the fact that 750,000 fraudulent votes will not be able to show up there because Pennsylvania has photo ID. And the Democrats...
Which is currently being challenged, right?
It doesn't make any difference. Okay. It's an exact replica of the Indiana law, and it's too late. Even the Democrats acknowledge that it's too late to change it, so it ain't going to happen. What do you think is going to happen right after Labor Day when the Catholic Church cranks up its pushback? Pennsylvania is 52% Catholic. You know, these are factors that the polls, they don't even touch. They don't touch enthusiasm. I have a friend who is a well-known pollster, and my son and I know him. I wasn't present for this conversation, but I got it from my son. So that's, Annie knows that in court, from one cop to another, it's not hearsay. So from one Collins to another, it's not hearsay. And my son told me that this pollster said anybody that says that they're giving you accurate polls is talking through his hat because we are having to work harder and harder to get Democrats to answer polls. So why do you think they're not answering, Mike? They're not answering because they have no enthusiasm for it. Enthusiasm is what drives people to the polls. And that's why
I agree with what you're saying. A couple things.
And I agree as well.
Number one is I agree with Doc that I don't think he's going to get creamed like the world thinks. I think something we're overlooking is since he has won, there's a huge portion of people that he has indoctrinated. I do think people like us know his game, and I hope you're right. I mean, Barack Obama is detrimental to our country. We know this, and so may Romney be. However, I think the important thing is that if we the people quit looking to Washington, D.C. for our answers and look to ourselves, there's the answer. My only main concern with Obama is whether he's rigged the election. He himself isn't very smart, but he's surrounded by people who know what they're doing. So the bottom line is it's just a matter of whether or not we the people decide that, as Tea Partiers, we're going to take our country back. Remember, Judge Napolitano himself said it the best. When Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration, a third didn't even care. A third wanted to stay with the king, but it was a third that did care that won
right.
This country a republic.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm glad you opened up the specter of possible voter fraud. Believe me, I worked in campaigns. I understand voter fraud. And I liken voter fraud to this. You go out to a baseball game with a few guys, and you're out in the outfield, and you see an outfielder make a lunging catch, grabs the ball perfectly, jumps up and fires the ball back into the infield. And you have some knucklehead say, yeah, I played baseball in high school. That's easy. I could have done that. My point being that everybody looks at what they think is involved in voter fraud and says, oh, yeah, that's so easy. They're going to do it. If voter fraud was so easy, what happened in Wisconsin where the unions poured, believe me, they're hiding the amount of money. They spent upwards of $50 million to try to dislodge Scott Walker, and they lost. And they didn't lose by a big number, 6 points, something like that. But they lost. They lost. So, you know, voter fraud is one of those boogeymen that the Democrats like to use to spook us and to dampen our enthusiasm. Oh, what's the sense? What's the sense? No matter what we – I mean, I've had people write to me and tell me that unless it's a 10-point margin – the Democrats will take it with voter fraud. And I say, oh, boy, brother, please, just think of what you're saying. The real margin, most people say it's probably about 3 points. And, Mike, this ain't going to be 3 points. No way.
No, I think I'm going to agree with you on that. You know, voter fraud is not exactly that easy. However, I had a clip of a gentleman, I believe it was up in the Chicago area, and he worked on the electronic voting machines, you know, the new computerized ones. And he explained in court under oath, sworn testimony, how he was able to rig the vote on these new electronic machines. And what we really have to watch out for, it's not so much if someone's coming in that doesn't have the proper ID voting. It's whether the machines themselves have been hacked. And that's
Danny, I don't want to take this over, but could we get to some of those good stories that I told you about in the book before we close down?
Sure. I was going to ask you about Penn State since you also coached basketball, but we can save that for another time.
Well, most people who have most people on the right that have anything good to say about any Democrat presidents will say they'll talk about Kennedy and they'll talk about Truman, and older people who are almost all gone now would also talk about Roosevelt. But the truth about these guys is really jaw-dropping. And there's one particular story that I really like to tell whenever I'm called upon to discuss my book, and it has to do with an incident that happened in 1942. It went something like this. The FBI brought a audio tape to Roosevelt in a special nighttime meeting. They had a transcript, a written transcript that went along with it. And they played the tape and asked Roosevelt to read along with the transcript. And it said, obviously, Mrs. Roosevelt is engaged in sexual intercourse with Mr. Lash. Now, Joseph Lash was a communist, not somebody that we called a communist, but a guy who was in charge of the Communist Party when he was younger. He was an out-and-out communist, and the Army intelligence was checking him out. They had his room bugged when up shows Eleanor Roosevelt, and who most people thought only played for the other team, but apparently she was a switch hitter, and Roosevelt became very angry, very agitated, as any husband would. He ordered everybody out of the office. He called his wife in, Eleanor. They had a big argument. I have this four different ways. I have this nailed down. At 5 o'clock the next morning, he ordered General Hap Arnold, who was in charge of Army intelligence at the time, and had Arnold. He ordered Arnold to have Lash, who was an Army Signal Corps officer at the time, transferred to the Japanese front within 10 hours. Now, so far, a lot of us could understand it. Roosevelt is angry. He's embarrassed. He used powers that we gave him for his own purposes. Okay, but what's next is disgusting, and this is why nobody can ever tell me anything good about Franklin Roosevelt. He then told Arnold to find out who in Army intelligence knows about this and transfer them to the Japanese front and keep them there until they get killed.
Whoa, I remember that in the book.
Keep them there until they get killed. This is like biblical. This is David and Bathsheba. This is awful. This is terrible. So that's my prize Franklin Roosevelt story. And of course, when he dies, he leaves the American government chock full of communists. And one of these communists was a guy named Harry Dexter White. Now, when Truman took over, Truman was a hapless numbskull. Believe me, all of this, the only good thing he did was drop those bombs. After that, he wasn't worth a bucket of warm spit. And Truman was handed a report from the FBI, from Hoover, in the beginning of December of 1945, saying, listen, you have this guy here, Harry Dexter White. He works for the Treasury Department. We are building a case, and we expect, because he is a communist spy, we expect to build a case against him and indict him for treason. Treason. Well, the FBI didn't trust Truman then, so they also delivered this same letter to Tom Clark, Ramsey Clark's father, by the way, and Clark got this letter, and they did nothing, except that 6 weeks later, Harry Truman then appoints Comrade Harry Dexter White as the head of the International Monetary Fund. And his job was to decide the exchange rate between the worthless Russian ruble and the American dollar.
Kevin,
we know the damage that did.
I agree with that. Now the Fed has to be audited. But we're down to our last 4 minutes. So, Kevin, I want to say thank you.
Wait a minute. Quick question for the coach. Eleanor Roosevelt was a switch hitter?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my God. She was disgusting. Not even a bull dyke would touch her.
Oh, wait a minute.
How
about our friend Hickok? His name was Eleanor or something similar to that. When Roosevelt himself was sworn in 1932, there's a picture of her standing next to him wearing a ring that her lesbian lover gave her. And it's a documented fact that she spent a night in the room with her lesbian lover in Washington, not with Franklin Roosevelt.
She's disgusting. Anyway, go ahead, Dan. Thank you for joining us, Coach. Oh, my God, that's disgusting.
Remember what I said about feeling I had to take a shower when I was doing the research?
Absolutely, Coach. And listen, we'll be down to see you probably the end of August, beginning of September. So say hi to your lovely Judy with us.
Well, that's great. That's great. And I look forward to it. And I hope we're still here when you're here, because we're going back up. But this has been a lot of fun, and I really appreciate the opportunity that you've given me. And it's coachesright.com. And I 300 to 500 word essays, and at the end of each essay is a way to get the book. But the direct website is crooksthugsandbigots.com. So
thank you, Kevin, and you have a great day, and I'll see you at the end of August.
You too.
Thank you, Coach, and thank you, Doc Jones.
Great meeting you, Mike. Bye now. Bye. Doc.
Okay, we do have someone else on hold, but unfortunately we're down to our last 2 minutes, so we can't get any more calls at this time. I apologize for that. But I want to remind everyone, we're going to be back here again on Friday, and returning is going to be author Ed Denzel, whose book is now out in a hardcover. It's a hard book. It's no longer just downloaded on Kindle. It's called Govicide. So we'll be back again on Friday, same bat time, same bat station, right? We had a great show here today, didn't we?
Awesome. Coach rocks, and of course Doc Jones does, and we'll see you on Friday, everybody. Good afternoon.
Yeah, so have a great week. Be safe, and I'll see you again on Friday. As soon as I can find my closing song. Here we go. Have a great week. Thank you, and God bless.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.com. www.southernsense.web.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American.